I'm excited. Today, I don't have to go it alone, especially on a topic as complex as diversity, equity, and inclusion. I'm joined by Glenda Testone. Glenda is our new and first CEO of the Nonprofit Leadership Lab, the best online membership site with content and community for board and staff leaders of small to mid-sized nonprofits. She also joins Joan Gary Consulting as my senior partner, and I am delighted that she is here with me on this episode and in leading our work in the lab. For the last 24 years, Glenda has been a leader in the nonprofit world, both on staff and boards. For the last 14 years, she was a leader in the LGBT movement as the ED of the New York LGBT Center, and during her tenure has made advancing racial and gender equity a focus of her leadership. Her personal journey started when Trayvon Martin was shot and killed, and this became part of her leadership imperative in 2016 when the organization embarked on its first staff-wide racial equity training. From there, the 35-year-old organization undertook a racial equity transformation that resulted in over 50% BIPOC board and staff leadership, a staff and board-wide education and training plan, and the creation of organizational values explicitly rooted in justice and equity. The lab team has serious aspirations to play a leadership role in strengthening the impact of the nonprofit sector, and key to that will be to strengthen and diversify the leadership of the nonprofit movement. Having just heard what I said about our new CEO and my co-host today, I think you understand why she is here. Our guest today has been my firm's partner, guide, coach, teacher, and advocate for the last 2.5 years, and we wanted to share him with you. Many of my episodes offer actionable advice, and others, what I hope is food for deep reflection. The episode falls into the latter category. I know those listening are not box checkers, although some funders do drive you there, and yet it just all feels like so much when there is already so much to do and when resources are too few. Dr. Pablo Ataola runs a consulting firm that centers nonprofits as a key client base. When we went shopping for a DEI consulting shop about 2.5 years ago, we were particularly struck by his emphasis on cultural intelligence and the change management lens through which he sees this work. I want to share him with you today. Let's go ahead and do that. Greetings and welcome to Nonprofits Are Messy. I'm your host, Joan Gary, founder of the Nonprofit Leadership Lab, where we help smaller nonprofits thrive. I'm also a strategic advisor for executive directors and boards of larger nonprofits. I'm a frequent keynote speaker, a blogger, and an author on all things leadership and management. You can learn more at joangary.com. I think of myself as a woman with a mission to fuel the leadership of the nonprofit sector. My goal with each episode is to dig deep into an issue I know that nonprofit leaders are grappling with by finding just the right person to offer you advice and insights. Today is no exception. Dr. Pablo Ataola is the principal of Thriving Culture, a consulting firm that partners with clients to attract a diverse workforce, motivate and engage employees, and create cultures of belonging where everyone can do their best work. Over the years, Pablo has developed various programs that train on organizational change, racial minority and women retention practices, multi-ethnic and religious identity, cultural intelligence, inclusion and diversity, leadership development, and gender equity. As a lifelong learner and someone who likes to improve organizational gaps, Pablo has a doctorate in leadership and organizational change, focusing on changes towards DEI from USC. His passion to take this information to equip organizational leaders to change systems and create new ones that allow all constituents to thrive. Pablo, thank you for joining us today and for sharing your insights with us. We're glad you're here.
Yeah, I'm so happy to be here with everyone.
Awesome. Excited. So Pablo, what should listeners know about you and the journey that has brought you to today?
I think, you know, I often think about being born in Argentina and how I would behave differently or just be differently. And I think coming from another country has given me a lens of what it means to be the other. And I came as a kid, so I didn't think about it that way. You know, I was just me and I just was reflecting back on, yeah, I didn't fit in so many ways. It wasn't my language. It wasn't my culture. The Latin people around me were not Argentine. So that changes everything, even changed my home. my parents, my siblings. So I started from that lens. Then I complicated it. Well, we complicated it with Anna, my partner, being not an immigrant, suburban Phoenix, white, middle upper class, all the other differences that were different than me. So then we were naive and we thought it was just about food and language and colors and maybe some customs. But then we encountered race and gender and systems. And then we had kids, and what language were they going to speak first? And what customs were they going to have? And, you know, we all kind of project onto our kids who we are. So that became another loop. So immigration, friends, then family, then kids. And throughout that whole time was work. Right. So work took me to school. As I learned more and more that I was usually the person in the room that raised my hand and said, hey, that doesn't quite fit people like me or communities that are different. So I want to learn more. And I made it my career.
That makes so much sense, Pablo. And I think for a lot of people, their personal life kind of leads into their professional life. So that makes a ton of sense. Speaking about professional life, the DEI landscape is really filled with different terms and acronyms, almost as many as the LGBTQ community. We have a lot of acronyms. Thinking about things like DEI and DEIB and JEDI and cultural intelligence and anti-racist, and we could go on and on for the whole podcast. But roughly, how do people understand this alphabet mix? How do you sort of talk about it and break it down?
So before I had an opinion, I just, like, you know, the whole raising my hands, like, hey, this doesn't quite fit people like me kind of approach. As things started to, I don't know, flourish, go into a budding season of understanding, maybe 20 years ago, I started to realize that the U.S. was having a conversation that Argentina was not having, and that conversation was in English and not in different languages, right? So as you asked me, like, hey, what, as you asked me what you asked me, I'm also hearing, hey, as we use English in the U.S., like, how do we talk about this when people in Argentina, as soon as I bring this up, they're like, what? This doesn't matter. Like, what? This is, that's a U.S. thing, right? So I do want to say we're having a U.S. Western conversation in English before I answer that. But regardless of country, China, Japan, Italy, here in the U.S., I think it's human nature to try to take a really complex thing, a really complex human dynamic, where a lot of emotions are being engaged, and emotions of like hyper interest and fire and hyper disinterest and apathy, right? Like, like there's a spectrum of emotions. So, so then what we do is we usually try to use language to simplify things. So that's what our brain does all the time with different things. And this is one of those things where, you know, it started with civil rights movement. Like, if we just talk about race, right? Like civil rights, then affirmative action, then eventually diversity, and then diversity needs inclusion. So you had D ampersand I, and then DEI, because you need equity, and then B, and then J for justice, and R for reparations, and whatever other part of the growing acronym until you get, I love that you brought up LGBTQ movement, because it's the same thing. Eventually you have to add a plus plus.
Yeah.
Why? Because DEI is just the world of difference that we're all in, and we need every letter in the alphabet, and then an additional plus plus to just understand this is complex. Let's keep it at the complex intersectional space. And for sure, you know, DEI is the main language, main acronym that has become a word, so I use it, but I use it within context. Usually a lot of questions I'm asked, I'm like, well, it depends. That's usually my answer, because it's never as simple.
What I like about your approach and what I think has really worked really well for our team is where you've actually landed. Like the phrase that you land on, or the hook you land on, that actually captures so much of this.
Cultural intelligence.
Yeah, that's the one.
That's a ticket.
I was hoping, that was a question. I was like, I'm going to say cultural intelligence. I hope that that's what you
do. You know, it's not, just so you know, podcasts are generally not pop quizzes, my friend.
You just said it.
That's true. Yeah.
So like talk about cultural intelligence. So talk about cultural intelligence and why it's not kind of a cop out, maybe.
Yeah. Right? And I had to wrestle with that. Go ahead, Glenda. You were going to say
No, I was just going to, a different way to say it. Why does it work for you? Why is that sort of the term that you're like, this is the one I can embrace?
And that's good, because I also say, you know, you don't have to use cultural intelligence theory or that. You just have to use something that works. And for me, this one works. And it works at a global scale, and has been proven to work at a global scale. And as I've used it, it's worked for me.
The reason it works for me is because we tend to have conversations in silos. If we're talking about race, we talk about race. And the reason we do that is not because we necessarily want to. It's just the way our brains work. It's really hard to hold the tension of intersectionality when our identities rely on it and respond to it. Because when we get emotional about something very personal, like race, like gender, like age, our brain has a hard time not going into in-group, out-group, fight, flight, freeze. And now if we don't recognize that it's the natural survival instinct of our brain when this whole work is happening, then we're going to stay at an intellectual level and we're going to miss it. So for me, I needed a new term that was not threatening for people, that would not be emotional from the get-go. I needed a new term that increased trust and lowered defenses. And then I couldn't just pick any term. I had to pick a term that actually showed a theory that actually worked, and that it worked in the complex intersectional approach to the human experience. So for me, cultural intelligence was that. Cultural intelligence is defined as the capacity to do a good job and be successful across culture. Mm-hmm. Now, when we think about culture, we think about, you know, probably like Mexican culture and Chinese culture, et cetera. But culture is anything, and microcultures are everything. So you have racial culture, gender culture, racial gender culture. So it's anything, right? What was strategic for me about it is, if I can make a person, a team, an organization better around difference, then any difference they engage, they'll be better now than they were before. And it's a journey, right? So if we can continue to celebrate those wins, then that will create a learning culture that can work through tension and through the anxiety that this work creates in people as they literally fight to not go into fight, flight, freeze, but stay in the strategic part of our brain. So for all those reasons, this really worked for me.
I had a podcast recently with a person named Tiffany Janna, who wrote a book along with a co-author called Subtle Acts of Exclusion. And Pablo, I think you and I talked about this book. And it is a reframing of microaggressions to something else, to subtle acts of exclusion. Tiffany's argument is that they are neither micro nor aggressions. So I think it feels like it's similar, is to try to capture something that does not, you know, sort of doesn't take away, but allows more people in some ways.
I really appreciate this approach, because it feels like very much the opposite of a checklist approach. So I want to talk about what, you know, when anti-racist is sort of like, okay, we want to be anti-racist, and then we're going to become anti-racist, and we're going to check that box. And there are no boxes. You just don't. This is forever work. And whatever difference it is, there are more differences to incorporate into that. So I'm curious about, when you work with clients and you see RFPs and clients who are looking to work with whatever they call it, whatever letters they use, but a DEI, let's say, consultant, how do you know if they're ready? I'm guessing you don't just scan the sheet for some particular words and say thumbs up or thumbs down, but how do you actually tell, you know, when someone's ready? And how on the flip side, have you read RFPs where you're like, oh, these folks are not ready, can't do it?
Yeah, I mean, there's two primary types of RFPs or approaches to this work, whether it's written on a napkin or in an RFP. Is it tactical or is it transformational? And they're both okay. But to make this work sustainable, we need culture change. So that's just a fact. And maybe an organization is not ready for that, or maybe they have already achieved that in some way, shape, or form. So I'm okay to engage a tactical approach. But in the process itself, I start to try to take a look of what's connected to the tactics and what is needed. Because sometimes people just don't know, and I don't want to fault people for not knowing. I do want to engage. But one clear-cut line for me is when we start to, you know, wade into the deeper parts of the pool, if the motivation is there. I'm okay if knowledge is not there. I'm okay if strategy is low because knowledge is low, or, you know, I'm even okay if behavior change is not readily accessible to people. But if motivation is not there, then it's not a hard stop, but it's a hard stop to general conversation and a very direct conversation around, why do you want to do this? If people are doing this for the wrong reasons, then it's not going to be sustainable when it gets hard. If people are doing this for fear or legal reasons, those are great reasons. Like, I am led by fear and legal reasons, right? At times. Well, all the time, maybe. But if people don't have an understanding, like if they're not motivated because this is good for the organization, extrinsic motivation, and they're not motivated to some degree because I want to be a better leader, I want to be a better human to other humans, then all the other reasons have been proven in research not to work. So I just say that point blank, like, hey, you're here, not here, unless you show me otherwise, because you've shown me this. So we can now engage in a very tactical conversation that's not transformational, knowing that you're probably going to jump ship pretty soon when things hit hard.
Yeah.
This actually leads me to a conversation Glenda and I were having about her own experience at the center. I'm actually going to now make you're moving from an interviewer to an interviewee.
I didn't sign up for that.
And you were talking about how some organizations think they can just sort of, you use the word just, it's just about this, or it's just about that. And I thought maybe you could talk a little bit about that, because I think it kind of bridges from what Pablo was talking about with regard to tactics.
To be fully transparent and vulnerable, I have done it both ways, actually, at the center. When we first did our staff-wide racial equity training, I thought, okay, we've started somewhere. We've done something. Check. And it didn't really result in a whole lot of change for all the reasons that you mentioned, Pablo. And it wasn't until a few years later when we were in a different place, had different internal resources. I had come to a different place of, I think what I heard you saying was like the why someone is doing this is so important. And my why changed. It was no longer like, this is something I should do. This is something I should do to not get in trouble. Or even like, this is the right thing, I should do this. It became a, like, there is an equity in the world. I am leading an organization. If I do not transform our organization to be in opposition to that inequity, then I am furthering it. And I don't want to do that. As a human being, I don't want to do that. As a leader, I don't want to do that. So I think that, you know, the organizations that say, we just need to diversify our board, or our staff is all white, or, you know, whatever they say, that it misses the point a little bit. I think you have to realize that this work is deep and foundational. You don't have to, to your point, you don't have to realize right away, you know, but I think the why is really important. Like, if you don't believe that this kind of change is critical to your mission, you're not going to stick with it. And that's one of the first things we did when we got serious about this work, was really write up, like, why is being racially equitable critical to meeting our mission? For us, that was the way in, was through racial equity, and then expanding through there, because the organization's history was so white. So we had to kind of counter that to begin with.
Yeah, it's interesting. The other thing in the box checking category that we've seen is uptick in the hiring of chief diversity officers during the pandemic, and now the, you know, pretty sizable percentage of them that are being laid off, and diversity finds its way into human resources, and that is often led by, you know, sort of a white woman, or, you know, so I think, you know, I do think that this whole notion of why really does come into play. And we'll talk a little bit about, as we go through this, we'll also talk a little bit about trust too. I want folks to actually more deeply understand this notion of cultural intelligence. Most people, and I've done a couple of podcasts on this idea of emotional intelligence and how much of an importance it is in for leaders. Talk about CQ a little bit in its role in driving an organization to a place where everyone feels a true sense of belonging.
Yeah, so for me, it goes to leadership right away. When you asked me that question, leadership shapes culture. And there's some research that shows that about 80%, you know, it's not an exact number, but a large percentage of how a single human behaves, aka the CEO or the executive director or the president, that gets interwoven into the fabric of the organizational culture, which is structure, process, what we do, what we don't do, what food we eat, what we actually have to do because the CEO is too anxious to let us actually talk to them about the thing that they're anxious about or whatnot. So for me, CQ or cultural intelligence of the CEO is crucial. And what this is not just another intelligence. You know, there's so many intelligences out there. EQ or self-awareness and emotional intelligence is part of it. So how self-aware someone is, it's just part of how successful people will be in cross-cultural engagement. But EQ is something that, you know, we usually measure in the same culture, right? Like, how can I read the body language, the emotions of different people, et cetera? But very often there's cross-cultural misunderstandings and misjudgments because EQ is only based in one culture versus across cultures. So we have to really look at all of the intelligences, leadership capacity, competencies, et cetera. That'll shape everything, right? That's one, leadership. The second one for me is structure. What is in place that collaborates with leadership to create psychological safety? So if we really want people to feel safe enough to risk their difference, different opinions, talk about the hard things, we not only need leadership to model that, but we also need the safety of policy to further know that we have a backbone to the intent. So structure, leadership, and then the last thing for me is process. What processes are there or not there that are impeding all the work that we're trying to do? Those three things are actually what are required for organizational cultural intelligence. And we can benchmark not only the leadership, but also structure and process to benchmark the whole organization. And when I think of, you know, so the CQ for the individual is how likely the individual is to be successful in cross-culture engagement. But organizational culture intelligence, the same definition, but parallel, right, to an organization, which is how likely is the organization to be successful in cross-cultural engagement, which now includes internally and with constituents outside of the organization.
The Nonprofit Leadership Lab is led by Joan Gary and is the world's best online community for leaders of small nonprofits. Learn how to raise more money, build the board of your dreams, grow a large audience of supporters, and so much more. To learn more and request an invitation to become a member, please go to nonprofitleadershiplab.com/podcast. That's nonprofitleadershiplab.com/podcast.
We are actually having a conversation with Dr. Pablo Ataola, and he is the principal of Thriving Culture, a consulting firm that partners with clients to attract a diverse workforce, motivate and engage employees, and create cultures of belonging where everyone can do their best work. And I am a satisfied customer. And one of the things that I have really learned a lot about through this work is that it requires a great deal of patience. And box checking is fundamentally an impatient activity. And this work is fundamentally requires a great deal of patience. And I feel like I've learned a lot from you, Pablo. I probably learning to be a little bit more patient is one of the many gifts that you've actually provided to me and to every member of our team. And I also just want to say for those of you who are listening that this benchmark stuff, it's real. Like you can actually look at where you are and you can reassess and see where you're at, and it's real and it works. So I really think that's just an important thing to think about. You know, we have been working with Pablo for 2.5 years and I hope to continue working with him, right? This is not a like, oh, we're going to do a 4-month strategic something.
No.
And in fact, when we began our work together, Pablo, I remember you put together the proposal, and I remember very naively, and you were very kind to me at that time, asking me why you were not training our team first. Mm. Like you said, we need to do a whole lot of assessment. And I'm like, well, don't you just want to just train us and then assess that your training went well? Like, I was actually thinking about it that way. So talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I'm going to go back to your word to respond, I guess. I'm going to go back to your word, patience. I'm not a patient leader. I'm a gut leader. Oh, this is a problem. This is what we need to do. And then we do it and make mistakes on the way, but I usually trust we'll figure it out. That's usually me in my most true core leadership. So, you know, as I reflect back on my response about what is cultural intelligence, it really does reflect the skill set that I learned in my doctorate journey of needing to slow down and benchmark, because training is usually about the head and knowledge exchange. It's not about culture change. And that's what I learned. I went into my doctorate saying, hey, I have these multiple year training programs for all of these diverse people groups, and it's working. And it was working to change those teams and individuals generally, but as those teams and individuals engaged the company and the culture, it didn't work. It actually created animosity, it created division, it created in-group and out-group within the same organization. And that's not what I wanted. But then as someone that was in that process and just head down into the process, then I raised the fist of justice, and they are unjust. And they weren't unjust. I just didn't know how to do organizational change. And I didn't have the leadership competencies to engage at a level that required what you're talking about, Joan, which is slowing down and thinking about an organization as a whole. So when we think about an organization as a whole, we have to think, well, we don't have to think. That's my Latin language coming out. We have an opportunity to think about organizational change and sustainability. So in order to do that, when we benchmark according to best practices and some theoretical framework, when we do the benchmarking, we now have the beginning of a journey. We now know where we are, and we can celebrate small wins. We can strategically plan for changes in a year, in 2 years, in 3 years. And it allows us a lot of times, I mean, this was an unintended consequence. I'm sure there's research out there about this, but I didn't know. It was really great to be able to have a mirror to the organization because of what people said about themselves. And so then it's not me, the outsider, or it's not any one person. It is, here's what you all are saying about yourselves. And here's what research we can tie that to that often says those kind of things. And it, again, it takes some of the tension out when we benchmark, because people are having a conversation without being able to have a conversation, whether it's in their own heads or through private chat channels or through phone calls or through 20-minute Zoom calls about how horrible something is, right? So if we actually let people bring it out in the open through the benchmarking, it is already a change management process. And it just takes the tension out of it a little bit, except for going back to an initial question that we had or initial discussion, it will reflect the leadership of leaders. So this will be an opportunity in the benchmarking, understanding the results, for leaders to say, am I really motivated to work on this stuff? Because it's usually about them in some way, shape, or form, right? So yeah, benchmarking takes time. You need to do it with best practices, but it's crucial if we want to make this work sustainable.
So a question for you, Glenda, when you went through the journey at the center, How much of this resonate, what you're hearing Pablo talk about, resonates for you in terms of process, benchmark, like sort of that, yeah. What he's talking about, and maybe as a little follow-up question, sort of navigating this emotion, this organizational change, I think is an interesting piece too.
We were so fortunate to have a great consultant that we hired to walk us through this. It was not Pablo, it was a different person, but they had a very similar approach. And so the first thing we did was an assessment, and I can remember being the leader at the time, being the executive director, there were painful things that I read that felt like, oh man, that's me. They're talking about me. And that's something I didn't realize I have to work on, and I have to work on it. The other thing, you know, it's interesting because over our years of doing this work, training was such a small part of it. And I think the reason for it, like you're talking about, Pablo, the connection between like cultural intelligence and organizational change. And organizational change was definitely foundational to our work too. The other thing that was foundational that people also had a hard time with, because it requires patience and work and practice, is that our work was really relational. So there was a phrase that our consultant said that we adopted that was, trust moves at the speed of relationships. So yes, we could both be the most well-trained to talk about equity or inclusion or diversity, but if we are not actually taking the time to build relationships with each other as human beings. So this is not just in a book, it's not a training, it's not theoretical, it's deeply human and vulnerable. That is when it's really transformational, and you have to practice it. You can't just read about it and have a book club discussion. You really have to like put yourself into it in a way that is relational and personal that I did not realize going into it. I'm so glad I did. It's been one of the best things I've ever done in my life. It's amazing and so positive. And it can be challenging along the way. And you're right. If you don't have the right why when it gets challenging, you'll probably stop. And that is, in my humble opinion, the worst thing you can do is stop doing this work.
Yeah. Right, or think you're done.
Right. Either way.
Yep. Okay, mission accomplished. Let's move on. So it feels to me that a core competency required in this work, actually, I think this is a core competency that's required in human beings. I feel like I want them to want this conversation to start in kindergarten, right? Is how the willingness to engage in difficult conversations, right? So nonprofit. Right. Nonprofit organizations are riddled with people pleasers, right? And it's very, and difficult conversations do not feel very pleasing. So, you know, your sweet spot, Pablo, is working with nonprofit organizations. How do you work with a client to provide them with the tools to sort of, how do you move an organization in the direction of being able to wade into the waters of difficult conversations?
By indirectly having difficult conversations about something else and building people's competency.
Yes. So it's a bait and switch.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, this is where I get into the social scientist part of, you know, my work, where sometimes you just need social experiments to test people's trust about sameness. Before you dive into the deep waters of trust around differences, if you actually, you know, start to like read all the how do you build trust blogs and research, et cetera, it's great around when you're exactly the same. You go to school in the same areas, you have a generally similar upbringing, et cetera, because usually you're less triggered. You usually don't go into the fight, flight, freeze, is what I'm trying to say, when there's a lot of safety around sameness. As soon as you go into the difference, you're triggered about something that some queer, Black, older woman said, not because of what they said, but because it's a parallel dynamic to something you experienced growing up at the age of 9 in your own home. So how the heck are we going to have conversations around intersectional, structural, historical, blah, 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 if we don't first work on humans being able to handle and engage in a productive, healthy way? So I usually, for my favorite tool, I'm giving all my secrets now. My favorite tool
is... Don't give too many of them away, Paula.
Well, I think this one's important because I want to live and have my kids grow up in a world where people are self-aware. So, hey, go look up the Enneagram assessment. And it is just a self-reflection on your personal preference of behavior. And it is not who you are, it's who you have grown up to be because of, you know, how you grew up. And that allows you to see how you start to behave under stress. Well, then just start to think about your own life and where things are stressful generally, I use that tool as a stepping stone to then use that tool around difference and say, hey, you all learn how to like behave around harder conversations in general. Now you learned each other's tells under stress and you get an opportunity to say, that's not who I know that person to be, because Glenda, we've built relationships, right? So as we talk about really hard difference things that maybe implicate me, not maybe, they do, you know, that now I could say, oh, wait, hold on. I know Jenny. I know Carlos. I know whoever, right? That's not who I've learned. That's not who I know them to be. So let me slow things down, take them out of fight flight with a great trust building question that sounds like, hey, I know you. That's not who you really are. What's going on? Can you just take a breath? Because you're acting under stress. And sometimes with an organization, that doesn't need to happen as much. And sometimes it needs to happen a lot. But that's where this is about human development as much as it is around the topic of race or gender.
So as you're doing this work with organizations, Pablo, I mean, one of the things that we encountered pretty quickly was like, okay, there's the work, there's our plan, there's the assessment, there's the next steps, how do we build buy-in? But communication is kind of underlying all of this. And it's both internal communication, like when you do an assessment, how much do you share with your staff or your board? And then there's the external communication. Do we tell people we're doing this? What do we tell them we're doing? How do you kind of navigate both internal and external communication as you do this work with an organization?
Yeah, so I love that you said that, Glenda, because communication can combat in such a positive, healthy way perception. Because the way I think about it is we all have perception, which perception is always incomplete, right? It's one window into a full house of many rooms, many sides, right? So we can't see everything. But perception drives belief. I believe this is true. And belief drives behavior. So early 20 years ago, I would say, oh, is that white CEO's fault that this is all happening? If they just would. My perception was that CEO was white. They might be from Spain. You know, like, I don't know. There's all kinds of assumptions and bias and perception. So I think communication starts to engage where perception is and starts to shape and mold perception with more clarity and a more full understanding of the whole house. So sometimes that looks like just an email and an intranet page. It's better when we understand where individuals might get triggered and might have to have one-on-one conversations before we send that email. We might have to have conversations with a team before that team learns about something that is happening that is crucial to the organization, but might not feel good or might negatively engage that perception. So a full-blown internal, external 360 approach to communications, even if it's not like super robust, but that general understanding of where do we need to help shape and mold perception in a healthy way around this work that could trigger different people groups, parts of the organization, different funders, different board members to leave emotionally, quit, or leave altogether. Right. Because once people understand, usually that journey of understanding through communication, a lot of times one-on-one communication, they tend to be able to want to hold attention or be willing to hold attention that this work will bring into an organization longer.
What about outside the organization, Pablo?
Yeah, that's always a tricky one, right? Like as an immigrant, I know that like as a person of color, immigrant, even though I'm white presenting, you know, like I want to control things. I want to control perception because negative perception could hurt me.
Yeah.
So that's what I hear you saying, Joan, especially in the nonprofit sector. How might it hurt our mission? How might it hurt our funding? How might it hurt the local council that is influencing our program? Right. So you have to do it. You have to have robust conversations. Ideally, if you have representatives of those different external communities, they'll be able to more accurately tell you how to communicate to get to the same goal, which is still achieve your mission, still keep going, still stay together, still keep most people in, it's crucial to have it, and you know, very practically on the internet. What emails are you writing? What phone calls are you making? What external written pamphlets do you have that you now have in the church or the community or whatever space? These conversations around communication and perception are everything for me. This is where I get the most context, where I really get to know how to communicate, aka in a culturally intelligent manner to different constituents, that have a different culture than me, whether they're men, women, anything in between, black, white, purple, it doesn't matter. It's who are they that are listening so I can speak their language in a way that helps us work together for the kind of future that we're trying to create.
So interesting. So Pablo and Glenda both know me as a person who was never in a classroom without a crucifix on a wall. And so A's on my book reports are meaningful to me. And it's so easy to feel like you're not getting it right or that you're not getting it. Think about somebody who's listening to this podcast, who's thinking about hiring an outside resource, right? So let's pretend I'm interviewing you, Pablo, as a nonprofit leader. How will I know our work together has been successful?
We didn't stop is a huge one. I guess I would say if we start and we didn't stop, if we got through the other side of tension and anxiety, that's success. There's several stages of culture change. The first one is awareness. When you become aware of the things you weren't aware of and you have this like, oh crap moment, you know, if I wasn't on a podcast, I would say a lot more instead of crap. But because that's what it feels like. It's so threatening. Humans, especially in the nonprofit world, we want to build and preserve relationship, and the threat of breaking relationship is horrible. It's horrible. So we have to work through the threat of breaking relationship. And the first part is becoming aware of what we weren't, right? And then as we get good at what we now know, that is what I call failing forward. That is what I call learning. So are we successful in continuing to fail forward, and the fail gap lowers, it diminishes because we won't intellectually get to know everything about everyone, but the more we learn about how to engage across difference, we diminish our own shadow side to our own humanist and leadership so that we can engage difference with curiosity and questions in such a way that we learn when we need to learn. When we are in our space, we just flow. But the intersectional space, if we work through the anxiety, is great. It's great for me, actually. It's horrible for the person going through it because it's a lot of anxiety. Those are two anxious spaces for me as an outsider to an organization. Yeah. Oh crap! I just sent the report. What are they gonna think? Are they gonna fire me? Are they gonna freak out? Yeah. And so there's a lot of strategy around that we can put together. But really, if we start, we work through the anxiety and we continue. And I think another benchmark, Joan, thinking about our current work with you, is you really start to get your people to tell you what they really think. That's
yes,
you.
Yes, that would be my opening to say that we just did some upward feedback to myself and the, you know, the co-owner of the business. And the good news is that our score, our benchmarking, we had benchmarked the team's sense of belonging and feeling of psychological safety. And we made enormous strides in a pretty short period of time. It's not a big team. That was the good news. And the different news was that people were just so felt so safe to be able to talk about, you know, who we are as leaders and managers. And I've never received that kind of pure, authentic feedback before. It was, to me, that was actually when I think about progress, I think about things like that. I think about what you said about, like, you don't talk about having difficult conversations. You actually just start talking about, you start having them.
Yeah.
And some of the work that we've done around building a business case for the work, or you know, the rubric we have created for the blog and this podcast and the conversations you have of what qualifies as a 4 on this and what qualifies as a 1, how will I know I'm doing this right? All of those kinds of things, you know, you think that this kind of work isn't kind of quantifiable, but it actually is in a lot of very, very interesting ways. And I actually think that was new for me. Mm-hmm. And I bet it is like wacky ass headline news for most boards that you can actually do this work and measure and really measure its significance.
Yeah.
I was just going to add, I think starting, coming back to the beginning of what Joan said, there's a saying in 12-step, which is progress, not perfection. And I feel like that so applies to this work. And it really helps to understand, like, this work is not quick. It's not problem solving. It's forever work. It's progress, not perfection. People are going to make mistakes. People are going to step in it. People's feelings are going to get hurt. But to your point, Pablo, as long as people keep going, that is the progress. And speaking for myself as also a you know, recovering perfectionist and people pleaser, I really pushing myself to do this work went a long way towards having me let go of both of those things, because you really have to be willing to go into it authentically and to be measured in some way as a leader to know that I'm going to get honest feedback about how I'm doing.
Yeah. And I think as people are talking about this work and trying to get boards to approve resources for this work, there can be some skepticism about this, or can be some feeling of risk associated with it. Right. But I do think it feels often to the transactional board member as a task as opposed to a journey, and a sense that it is not something that you can actually sort of measure. And busting those myths with your board can go a long way towards aligning you with your board as well. So we're actually just about out of time. So I wonder, as you think about this, Pablo, I mean, I'll start with you, and then I'm actually going to end with Glenda here, is thinking about who's listening to you, someone who's on this journey, maybe feeling impatient, or someone who's really trying to infuse this sense of belonging into their organization. Other than providing your website address, what else might you offer them in terms of suggestions or advice?
I would say this: people are dying of thirst for leaders and organizations that are an oasis of doing this work well. Mm-hmm. It's in us without knowing. It's the answers to the questions we've been asking. It's even the questions that we didn't know we wanted to ask. We're like, humanity is so incredibly thirsty for a place that's doing this well. So for me, the risk is not to become one of those places. I could talk about, you know, all of the research that talks about how this makes an organization more profitable and more creative and innovative, and all those things are true. But I think at a human level, we're looking for the next leader, for the next organization, for the next sector. I think the nonprofit sector touches every sector. I think it's heart-driven. And I think the soil in the sector is ripe for just luscious growth. Yes, is there legal risk? Yes. Is there risk of being called a racist or, you know, negatively engaging? Yes. But the risk of not doing this work and becoming the things that the organization and leader that we all desire to just follow on social media, to read books from, to go work for, that's what I would want to leave people with. It's just that just like desperate need to pursue this at a human level. Because I need this. I need my kids to see this.
Yes. I would argue it is the sector to get this right. I mean, when you think about what the nonprofit sector is fundamentally about, what it's in the service of, it is the model that others should be following. And so to those of you who have, you know, sort of not stepped into this work and are struggling to get your organization aligned, I hope this was helpful. To those of you who are in it, and it feels really hard, don't stop.
Keep going.
Keep going. And be sure that if you do hire an outside resource, and I would make an argument that this is almost nearly impossible to do without an outside resource. So let me make that argument that you really, develop a serious relationship with that firm or that person and have a lot and build a trust there. Make sure you're aligned on the why and that you really understand their approach and that you remember as, you know, sometimes it's hard for me. Oh yeah, they're the experts. Really understand where the consultant is coming from, the sort of the root of their why. I feel like I have learned a lot about that. I learned a lot about it when we did an interview for DEI consultants, but I've also come to appreciate Pablo for having a really clear and in some ways unique approach from my lens. And so with that, I just really wanted to say thank you to Glenda, and thank you to Pablo for everything that you have done for my enterprise and for all the good work you do for your clients. I think a wise man on a podcast said people are thirsty for this. So thank you. Thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure as always.
All right. Well, thank you everybody for joining us. And as always, please take good care of yourselves, and thanks for everything you do every day to change the world in ways large and small. And I will talk to you next time. Take good care. Thanks so much for spending time with me today. I hope you found the conversation valuable as you navigate the messy world of nonprofits. Check out all my other resources at joangary.com. Hope you find them helpful too. Lastly, thank you for the work you do to repair the world in ways large and small. I'll see you next time.